Welcome to episode 16. I'm talking like this because we'll be talking about computers only. It's hard to talk like that, so I'll stop. Anyway, coming up on today's episode of All Movie Talk, a controversial take. Haven't done one of those in a while, but Steven's going to explain why he is wrong about the movie Tron. And, of course, a computer-related trivia question. Diverging from computers and stuff, we'll be talking about sound. Continuing our discussion from the previous week, this time we'll be talking about how sound changed the industry back when it was based on silence. And a top six list, as always, about the top six computer movies. Wrapping it all up, a series spotlight about five movies that you probably maybe even haven't heard of. We certainly mentioned them on the show, though, so we'll go into more detail. It's the Antoine Doinel films. Five movies started in 1959 and continuing on for the next couple decades. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller, and man, I think it's a real risky choice of us two guys who distribute a show that's only available on the internet to talk about computer movies. Do you think any of our audience is at all interested in computers?
Well, this is going to be a little esoteric, but I think we'll be able maybe to convert a lot of people into using computers and being excited about them.
Have you guys heard about this thing called the internet? It's really awesome.
Yeah.
We're doing a little bit of a computer theme today. We're going to talk a little bit later about our top six computer movies. And in that vein, I'm going to do a controversial take about something that will destroy pretty much all of my credibility on the internet. And that is, I'm going to explain why I don't like the film Tron.
What?
Yeah, I know. Tron, the 1982 Disney picture with the great special effects. And, you know, the one thing I will say for it, first and foremost, I understand that the special effects were revolutionary at the time. I appreciate them on that level. Definitely interesting to see in terms of film history. It used a lot of computer effects early on in the 80s, and also a lot of optical effects. So I think people believe that more computers were used than were in the film. It's actually a lot of old-school effects. Anyway, my big problem with Tron, and I have trouble understanding what it is that people like about it, the movie's completely incomprehensible. The basic plot is about Jeff Bridges is a computer programmer who gets sucked into a computer world where he has to fight evil computer programs, and I don't understand all what's going on, and the computer programs look like people, and they look like their creators, so what the heck is happening in this movie? It reminds me of the plot of a video game from the 1980s, which is to say it doesn't make any sense at all. Just randomly, the characters meet up, and then they have tasks that they have to accomplish. They accomplish the task, and then they go to the next level, and there's some new random task, and now we are on light motorcycles, and now we have to build a solar sail ship. What the heck is happening?
And well, it's a bit more than that, but go on.
Is it? I have trouble. And honestly, I mean, I went and looked online, all right, and Wikipedia has 1,500 words on the movie's plot, all right? That's 3.5 single-spaced pages of text about the movie's plot, and I still don't understand what the heck is going on in it. I mean, there's this whole story that's happening outside of the computer universe about evil bad guys who stole Jeff Bridges' work, and there's an evil sentient computer program that Jeff Bridges has to fight, and I don't get it. I really just don't understand the progression from one level to the next. I guess it creates a world, but only barely, because it doesn't really explain much of it. Just, there's some I.O. towers, and we have to do stuff with them so that we can get, again, to the next stage. I mean, can you explain to me anything at all about the story? Is it comprehensible to you?
All right, well, let me, rather than respond directly to your comments, let me go back and kind of take this from the top, because the plot, as far as the outside world plot, I think is definitely very ordinary. I wasn't so thrilled with the live-action pieces of it, but basically, you know, these people wind up getting trapped into a computer. And this is a silly idea. For some reason, it's done all kinds of other movies, but this one doesn't want you to take it literally. This is not a literal computer. This is like an Alice in Wonderland situation where these people wind up not really intending to go there, but suddenly they wind up in this Wonderland where the rules don't make sense. And I definitely think if you think of Alice in Wonderland, this will give you the sense of it because it's a different world, but the idea is the same. The
plot is for these human characters to figure out how to survive and get out of this world that does not make any rational sense, that they do find themselves winding up playing live video games. And so you get into this technological wonderland, and what I liked about this movie is how the human characters aren't just these tour guides that take you through this world. They have to be on guard. They have to be smart and resourceful to survive. They have to catch on and figure out that what the rules are to this world, even if it doesn't make any rational sense. And so it becomes this intellectual game where you have these intelligences pitted against each other, and the humans have to outsmart the other side, but they don't know, you know, they don't understand the rules of the game. But they do figure things out. There's this one situation where a human disguises himself as a computer program, one of the enemy, and he's forced to behave like one, and that's why he ends up playing video games, I think, is because he has to play that role as best he can, even though he doesn't really understand it. And so I just love how crazy it is, but how it's about these characters adapting to this world.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it's crazy, and they don't understand the rules, but that's because the rules are completely random.
Well, no, I think there are rules. I don't know that we get the sense of it, but I think we do get the sense. I think the movie conveys a sense that there are rules, and they have to be followed, because they do give the human characters certain goals, and they just have to figure out how to meet them.
Yeah, my problem, though, is that the goals just seem like they all come out of thin air, out of nowhere, and once they're done, to me, it doesn't feel like anything's adding up to whole. It just feels like a video game where, okay, you've beat level 1, time to do level 2, time to do level 3, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, that's not at all satisfying as a story.
I just didn't get that impression. I mean, definitely it's not rational, but I don't think it's supposed to be.
Well, and my other complaint with the movie, and this is probably a tougher sell, is I don't really like the graphics that much.
Oh!
I know. They're interesting, and I kind of appreciate the style, but I think ultimately they couldn't quite get what they were trying to achieve.
What were they trying to achieve?
Well, I mean, I think they were trying to create a more realized world, but everything looks a little too wireframe, a little too much like a vector video game from the 1980s, and the world itself, I think, looks a little indistinct. It's hard to tell exactly what different things are supposed to be. I kind of dig the general style with the people with the blue lines or the red lines or the yellow lines all over their body. That's kind of interesting. But the world itself, the environment, I just think it looks murky and hard to tell what anything is. I think it adds to my confusion about the storyline.
I think the look of it, the colors especially, the kind of muted blues and everything that you see, was a result of the animation process that they use. And actually, just to be a little technological for a moment, just for some background, they use a process called backlit animation. And it was very expensive, and I don't think there's any other feature film that has used this technique because it was just so expensive and did create a world that looks a little cold, and maybe that turned people off. It's not quite the colorful, you know, Alice in Wonderland. You have all kinds of colors and movements and characters and everything, and this is kind of a cold landscape, but I think that's the point. They're inside a computer. And one thing I liked about the world is the integration of the human characters with it. If you think back to Mary Poppins or anything where they mesh live action and animation, sometimes successfully, but it always looks like different people in a world they don't belong in. And this, when the humans get in there and they're kind of taking the guises of computer programs within this computer, they really look like they belong there. The images of the actors are sort of processed in a way that they mesh a bit with the animated backdrops and stuff. And I think that's a really remarkable achievement when you think about it, and helps sell you on this being a real place, even if it's not a rational place.
I guess. It kind of bugs me because all the people in the real world have doubles in the computer land, right? I mean, they all have, like, programs that are their equivalents, and so sometimes I'm sort of confused, you know, is this the human or the computer program that's representing the human? And I didn't quite understand why all the computer programs look like their users or whatever. I was just confused about the rules, and I don't think that the visuals helped distinguish anything at all for me. That's just where I could never quite get into it. Now, I want to say, I really wanted to like this movie. I saw it as a kid and didn't like it.
Oh, really?
But I heard so much great things about it, and it's such an icon in, you know, the computer industry that I went back and watched it as an adult, and I was, like, all excited to see it, and I still didn't get it at all.
That's really funny, because obviously this is made for a younger audience than us. And I was going to say, if you'd seen this for the first time as an adult, then, you know, I think you lose something if you don't see these movies at a younger age. But it sounds like you're an exception to that, and also I am. I did not see this as a kid. I saw this later in life, but I still loved it. And so I don't know how to explain that particularly. But back to the visuals, just another comment on that. This will be controversial with you, I guess. But I think that if you pause this movie at virtually any point, inside the computer, the sequence, not the outside world, I think the chances are pretty good you'd have an image there that you could quite easily imagine hanging in a museum, at a modern art museum or something. I think it's that good. And it's not just this stuffy kind of highbrow art either, but something that has a tangible, visceral energy to it. You see these receding backgrounds that you said the line. I think the lines are perfect because these grids and wireframes and stuff, that's the idea of it, but they stretch off into the background. They have these looming shapes that they look like geometric shapes, but they're just towering above you. And very simple shapes and colors, but combined in ways that are beautiful and I think evocative. I think it's kind of like this weird cross between Dali and Escher. It's just, there's nothing else that looks like this. There's no other movie that looks this way.
Yeah, Dali and Escher run through an Atari 2600, maybe.
Yeah, well, sure.
But yeah, I think I agree. It's visually interesting by itself, but for me, the kind of confusing surrealism didn't help me at all understand what was happening.
Okay, well, all right.
Though we did get discs of Tron out of it, which was a great video game. Much better than the normal Tron video game. If you ever have the opportunity to play an arcade cabinet, discs of Tron, you should take it. So yeah, I guess, again, as usual, neither one of us has convinced the other one of much, but I think this will probably be a topic we'll discuss on our website some more. So if you want to chime in, drop by allmovietalk.com and let us know how you come out on Tron.
Well, since this week's episode is all about computers, or partly about computers, it's only right that our trivia question touch on the subject. This is a two-part question with surprisingly related answers. One, what was the first feature film to use 2D computer-generated imagery? Two, what was the first feature film to use 3D computer-generated imagery? If you don't know the answer, we'll give you partial credit if you come up with about when these movies were made. What do you think about today's trivia question, Stephen?
I think I'm not going to get it right.
Okay, well,
which is pretty much the normal.
All right, well, we'll see how you do. Well, this is a special segment of All Movie Talk because we have a guest star to help us talk about sound, continuing from last week. Our guest star is Stephen Keller. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Wait, I'm a guest star? What are you doing to me here? I made you and I can take you down. It's all the same, Stodder. Don't you doubt it for a second.
All right. Well, okay, Stephen has been around forever. He's like a piece of the furniture and we all ignore him. All right, last week we talked about the technological advances with sound in film. This week we want to continue that discussion, focusing on how the advent of sound changed the art and the industry of movie making. I came up with four different categories for changes that happened, two positive and two negative, so let's do the positive ones first. One aspect is sort of obvious, and that's the brand new commercial market, namely the sale of soundtracks. These days, you can get pretty much whatever movie music you want on a soundtrack, and often movies will feature original songs or new covers of old songs that hit big, a lot of them with the intention of hitting it big and selling soundtrack albums. This actually dates all the way back to 1928, the first year that sound movies began to be made with any degree of frequency, and that's when the Al Jolson movie The Singing Fool featured the first song ever to sell over 1 million copies, and actually it wound up selling over 3 million copies. So right at the birth of sound, this whole new industry, we get the beginning of what will become standard practice of marketing a soundtrack along with a movie.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. I think it's interesting how much it changes over time. You know, for a long time, movies used a lot of older songs that have been around. You know, I mean, Casablanca uses As Time Goes By, which was not written for the movie, but that became a huge song, you know, got lots of radio play and became a big seller in its time. But for a while, I think there was a real trend toward movies using original music, especially in the 60s and 70s, where you see more composers composing stuff directly for the films. But then in the late 70s, and especially in the 80s, after the success of Saturday Night Fever in the 1970s, you see a real sense of using pop songs in soundtracks and selling both at the same time. There was a time period where they would actually advertise the songs that would be in the movie. You'd see a movie trailer and it would say, also featuring a new song by Prince or whatever. It's gone back. Again, we don't see it as much anymore.
I think because it's become a cliche, the whole montage that is accompanied by a pop song has sort of fallen out of fashion because it's
right.
So overused. But yeah, you're right. A lot of original songs and also a lot of revivals still. I remember the 1983 movie The Big Chill was all about these aging people from the 60s generation. and it had just tons, wall-to-wall 60s songs that are really great songs. It revived a lot of interest in these older songs, like Ghost did for Unchained Melody and things like that. So we see not only the revivals going on, but also the original soundtracks as well. I also want to talk a bit about how talkies opened up the doors to creativity. All of a sudden, filmmakers had a brand new tool in their toolbox to play with and experiment with. Obviously, a lot of movies show how some filmmakers didn't really know what to do with it, yet right off the bat, we start to see some real creativity. For example, in 1929, Alfred Hitchcock makes the movie Blackmail. And this was originally intended to be a silent movie, but partway into filming, it was converted over to a sound movie, and scenes were reshot, and ultimately became not actually the first British sound movie, as it is often thought to be, but certainly the first British film where sound was stored directly onto the film instead of a phonograph record. Anyway, right away in this very early sound movie, we see an intriguing use of sound. The main character is a woman who is attacked by a man, and in defending herself, she kills him with a knife. The next morning, she's sitting at the breakfast table, and everyone else is talking about the murder from the previous night. It's appeared in the papers. And we zoom in on this woman's face, and the dialogue gradually fades out on the soundtrack, except for the word knife. Whenever anybody says the word knife, it is loud and clear, and every other word is just this indecipherable murmur. It's a really neat way to use sound to let us into the character's head. It's almost an audio version of expressionism. We think of expressionism in terms of the visuals, but this is an audio equivalent. It's using dramatic, exaggerated use of sound to reflect this character's state of mind.
Yeah, I love that. Anyone who's seen that movie loves that scene. It's so imaginative. And it's kind of a shame that you don't really see that anymore. It's rare that a movie uses sound that creatively. I mean, every director is not Alfred Hitchcock by any stretch, but I think a lot of people could learn from these early movies where there were sound and silent sequences, and so they used sound more creatively. Today, I think it's taken for granted.
Yeah, and to go back on Hitchcock again, I remember an interview with him, and he was being asked about the movie The Lodger. And there's a couple of really interesting visual sequences in The Lodger where, like, this one shot that looks down on a spiral staircase, kind of like in Vertigo, that famous shot, but this is a staircase where somebody is walking down the stairs, and you just see the hand moving down the banister, and you don't see him walking down, you only see the hand sliding down. And another shot in The Lodger is where the lodger, the title character, is living in this upstairs apartment. And down in the floor below, you see this one character looking up at the ceiling. And the ceiling fades away and suddenly becomes transparent, and we start to see the character's footsteps pacing back and forth in the room above. Now, Hitchcock said that these were both replacements for sound, and if he had had sound, he would have just had the footsteps sound out on the soundtrack, and so then you know that the character's pacing back and forth, but he didn't have that tool, so he used the visual trick of the ceiling becoming transparent. Now, you can argue about which way was better. I mean, I think in The Lodger, these two sequences are very evocative, but it shows you how he would have, this one filmmaker, would have changed the whole way he shot the movie if he had had sound.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think it's really interesting to watch, like, the great directors who worked in both silent and sound and who made the transition, like Hitchcock or Fritz Lang in Germany, because they used sound in very interesting ways. I think because they had experience with what it was like to shoot silent films. Today's directors have obviously never worked without sound, so again, like I said before, it gets taken for granted. We're not using sound as creatively because we're so used to it.
Well, that brings me to a couple of the negative effects of the transition to sound. One is that creativity with visuals took a real hit and set things back a little bit. In the 1920s, expressionism and surrealism and a number of other movements produced some brilliant, wild, evocative images, real spectacles sometimes, moving cameras, strange camera angles, innovative uses of split screens, and a lot of other things. Everything you think of older movies not being was being done in the 1920s, and sound just ground all this to a halt because almost overnight it turned movies into these static filmed stage plays for the most part because the early primitive technologies for recording sound required that the actors more or less stay put and face toward where the microphones were hidden, and especially early on when they didn't even have boom mics, they were hidden in clothing, and the camera basically had to stay put too. So innovation on the visual side suddenly became a lot less interesting, and movies became observers of comparatively static scenes. Eventually technology would catch up to where the visuals could be free again, But it's a long time before filmmakers really tap into using the potential of creative, evocative imagery as a matter of course, because now sound has split the attention of filmmakers. They have to pay attention to both, so they're not focused on the one or the other.
Yeah, I think it's like when we talked about color way back in episodes 2 and 3, we talked about how, in a sense, having black and white gives you more focus, more focus on composition and other elements, because you're not distracted by color. Again, you know, sound is nice because it gives us extra information, but on the other hand, like you say, it diverts attention, it makes things more complicated and more difficult, and thus can be a negative.
Right. So, finally, final point for this segment, probably the most notorious thing, in fact, about the transition from the silence to the talkies, was the impact it had on the careers of many of the top filmmakers of the day. For starters, a whole lot of musicians that worked at theaters to produce live accompaniment for the movies suddenly found themselves unemployed. Movie theaters were the single largest source of employment for musicians, and that just suddenly dried up. The market was over. And unfortunately, this was also right about when the Great Depression was beginning, too, so it was a tough time all around. Also, obviously, the actors went through a huge turnover. A lot of the movie stars that looked great and sounded awful just vanished overnight, replaced by actors and actresses with great voices and also looked good. This is dramatized amusingly, but realistically, in the movie Singin' in the Rain from 1952. But it was tough to get work in the movies if you couldn't sing and have a great speaking voice. Stars like Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford and John Gilbert and Gloria Swanson all fell from the spotlight during this transition for one reason or another. Swanson, curiously, did make a comeback in 1950 with the most famous role of her career in Sunset Boulevard, where she played an actress whose career was ruined by the talkies. Sometimes Buster Keaton is cited as a star whose career dried up with the talkies. I think that had more to do with his signing a contract with MGM right as the talkies arrived, and MGM didn't handle him right, so it was the same sort of timing, but I don't think it was the same reason. Keaton actually had this wonderful baritone voice that was perfect for the talkies. Charlie Chaplin also survived the talkie era largely by continuing to make silent films. It wasn't until 1940 that he made The Great Dictator that used sound in a real pervasive sense. City Lights in 1931 was, I think, his best film, and it was a silent movie made during the talkies, and partially silent Modern Times in 1936. It had sound, but he was silent. But he made successful talkies as well, as I said, The Great Dictator, also Limelight in 1952, with Buster Keaton, in fact. Laurel and Hardy also made the transition without a hitch. They were just as prolific and accomplished with talkies as with the silence, perhaps because their voices really were everything their silent films suggested, but this was just not the case with so many actors, silent comedians as well as dramatic actors, and a lot of just people just disappeared overnight, and we had this sudden new crop of people like Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy and people who had good singing voices making musicals right at the dawn of the sound era.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things you mentioned, you had to have a good singing voice. I think it's weird when you watch a lot of early films, even up until the 40s, there's like a song in every one where, there's like, where a character will sing. And it'll be like in a normal drama, and you know, the female lead will be singing a song. And it's not a musical, but there's just, that's what people expected. They went to the movies for a show, and they wanted to see a story, and they wanted to see some music. The studios were also, of course, hoping the song would become popular. They mentioned with Casablanca, and they could go ahead and sell it and make some more money that way. And they do an admirable job. You don't think of Casablanca as a movie with music, but there's tons of songs in it, and famously, as time goes by. But that was because every movie that the studios produced was going to have a song at some point. It was going to be an important thing to the story. It's always kind of interesting watching that. If you look for it, you start noticing it all the time in older movies.
Yeah, and I like what you say about it not being invasive, because they aren't. I think a lot of people are kind of turned off by musicals because people sing at unrealistic times. But in movies that are not musicals, a good example is Gilda. This is a film noir. Everything's supposed to be dark, not sunny at all. And suddenly Rita Hayworth goes into this song that turns out to be probably the most memorable scene in the movie. But she's an entertainer at a nightclub, and it's her time to go on, and now we see the song. There's a plot significance there, too, of course, but when we back off, yes, they did work a song into the screenplay somewhere,
right.
Probably very much on purpose.
There's a reason so many female characters in movies from the 40s were torchlight singers.
Yeah.
It's not just because one out of every three women in the 1940s was actually employed in a nightclub. It was a convenient way to put songs into movies for Hollywood without seeming like a break from the plot.
One of the things we are interested in besides movies are computers. We're kind of computer geeks, and so obviously one of our interests is in movies that are about computers in some way or another. So our top six list for this week is going to be the top six computer movies. And my number six will immediately mark me for ridicule, I'm sure. It's the movie that taught me that you don't need antivirus software because you can erase viruses from your computer and all other computers and reverse the damage done by viruses just by hitting the escape key. Of course, it's The Net from 1995. A stolen identity thriller starring Sandra Bullock, and I just think it's a lot of fun. But you can laugh at me now, Stephen. Go ahead.
Oh, you like The Net. Well, I'm not going to even comment on that, honestly. My number six film is sort of a sideways choice. It's Sneakers, the 1992 suspense film starring Robert Redford by Phil Alden Robinson. And it's sort of a heist movie, kind of Mission Impossible type, where you have a bunch of different people doing crazy stuff. And the central plot revolves around this computer chip that can break any kind of encryption. Completely ridiculous, of course, but it is interesting. And the movie uses it as more than just a MacGuffin. There is some interesting talk about what would the world be like and who would use this sort of chip if suddenly there were no more secrets. I think it's an interesting idea because, of course, one of the things computers have done is allowed us to communicate in secrecy, something that has not been historically the case. And, you know, it's also just a fun movie. Not a great movie, but very entertaining and something I've enjoyed as sort of a sentimental favorite.
Oh, I would think it's at least almost great. What's interesting is if you think of the great team-based war movies like The Dirty Dozen and The Guns of Navarone, where you have these teams of experts in different fields, and they all pool their talents together to carry out some mission behind enemy lines, that is basically Sneakers. It's just not a wartime setting. The setting is swapped out for these heists and computer hacking and espionage and that kind of thing. I think it's a great movie, actually.
Well, I like how you like my movie more than I do.
Well, number five on my list is a movie from 1970. It's called Colossus, The Forbin Project. If you are a fan of Mystery Science Theater, you will know that this was Joel Hodgson's favorite movie. But anyway, the idea is there's this impenetrable computer that is built and given control of our national defense, and almost right away it starts exhibiting some unsettling behavior. There are a lot of movies about computers being given too much power and taking control, and this is probably the best of those, or one of them anyway, because it's completely devoid of theatrics and melodrama. It's just a really tightly edited movie that gradually builds up great tension. Part of the success is that the computer doesn't just, you know, I don't know, turn into a killer robot or anything. It's definitely very limited in its ability to perceive what's going on, and it can only communicate in a very limited text. So it's not humanized at all or magical. This is truly just a computer, but one that knows how to utilize the resources it does have. Today, I don't think it works really as the cautionary tale it was obviously intended to be, because I don't think we fear computers in that way quite as much. But it's still a great thriller, and for computer geeks like me, it has some great close-up footage of real working vintage computer equipment, not just blinky lights on cardboard panels.
You know, I've been meaning to see this movie for, I think, 10 years now, and I've always just heard nothing but great things about it. Sort of an under-the-radar movie, something I really want to check out. My number five movie is probably a more conventional pick for this list. It's War Games, the 1983 movie by John Badham, starring Matthew Broderick as a young computer hacker who accidentally hacks into a Defense Department mainframe that controls nuclear weapons and is playing some computer games. You know, he thinks he's just playing computer games and decides to play a game of thermonuclear war, because that sounds like a whole lot of fun, not really realizing what he's got himself into. Yeah, it's kind of ludicrous, and it may not be the best movie, but I gotta say, this is, you know, Sam's gonna pick some sentimental ones, and this for me is a sentimental favorite. It's an 80s movie that I kind of grew up watching, and I've seen it as an adult, and it's not great, but it's not that bad either. It's fun, entertaining, and it gives it a sense of, like, I think what we sort of thought of computers as in the 1980s when we didn't really understand them. Obviously, the PC was just sort of coming around that time period. People didn't have them in their homes. And this is an interesting look back at that era.
I'm glad you picked this because it did not make my list and I felt bad about it. It's certainly a classic. You know, it's one I feel that I missed out on. I saw it and I liked it, but I don't know, it didn't quite click as the great movie that people around me that have similar tastes as me thought of it, but I'm glad you picked it, because I think it deserves representation. Well, number four on my list, which I'm sure also made Steven's list maybe a little later on, it is Tron, the landmark 1982 hybrid of live action and animation. We've already discussed this thoroughly enough on this show, but I want to add one more observation, and that is that this movie and its unique look and feel could not have come about at any other time, even 2 years before, say, and the technology wouldn't have existed to create these images. And a couple years later, the lack of constraints, the technological constraints which restricted the animators to create these simple geometric shapes and colorings and stuff, that would have resulted in a movie with a completely different feel to it, and I kind of doubt it would have been as effective. But the enduring impact that Tron has is a sobering reminder that creative innovation isn't really so much about new technologies as using any technology in new ways.
Yeah, I think I've said my piece about Tron. I'm going to keep my foot on my mouth as much as possible and just keep going here. And my number four pick is where I cheat terribly and pick a robot movie, which doesn't quite qualify, but it's my favorite robot movie, so I'm picking it anyway. And I think I've chosen it in top six lists before, but it's Blade Runner from 1982 by Ridley Scott. And I just love the way it deals with these characters, the replicant characters. A robot, really just a walking computer in a sense, so these guys are walking computers. And I like the way, of all the movies that deal with computers who want to become human or robots who want to become human or whatever, I think this is the most interesting one of them that really psychologically paints an interesting picture of what it would be like to be not a human in a human society. And I think it evokes a lot of great science fiction novels that play on that similar theme but have rarely been translated to the screen in such a compelling way.
I think I agree with everything you said. I think you probably like it more than I do, but my number three, definitely a different kind of a movie. It's one of the oldest of all computer movies, and it's the 1957 comedy Desk Set, starring the wonderful Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Tracy plays this efficiency expert who is hired to examine the research department of a TV network. But Hepburn and the other employees in this office figure that this means that jobs are going to be cut. And so there's a certain amount of fun scheming on both sides, and eventually it comes to light that the office is to be computerized. And it's one of those great, totally wrong-headed ideas about what computers are. It's this giant box that beeps and lights up and gives you the answer to whatever question you want to ask it in English. But really what sells the movie are the stars, and this movie is great at demonstrating just why they're so good. The best scene is one in which Tracy and Hepburn sit down and have lunch together and banter back and forth, and they like each other personally, but their work is more important to them, so they have this secret agenda against each other. There's this tension, and it's just great to watch them spar with each other.
Interesting. Yeah, obviously they're a great couple. I haven't seen that particular movie. Yeah, I think it's interesting that someone worked a 1957 movie into our computer list. Good job, Sam. Well, my number three pick, it's The Matrix from 1999, of course, by the Wachowskis. And I like this movie in particular because it presents the idea of computer hackers in a more interesting way. What if your entire world was a computer that you could hack? What if you decided you didn't like the laws of gravity so you could change them? Anyone who's ever played online games sort of experienced this sort of thing, where there are, in fact, people who do use exploits in the game code to give themselves special powers they're not supposed to have, and it's interesting seeing this expanded to an entire world. I've discussed before my loathing for the Matrix sequels, but the original film still stands up as a great action movie that takes this idea of computers to a whole new level.
I love it too, and I still have fond memories of seeing it the first time in the theater with the great opening action and special effects sequences. I was just blown out of my chair. I did not include it in my list though, because I think mostly because I found other movies I prefer to talk about, but I'm glad you mentioned it. My number two, hey, it's Sneakers from 1992. And just to add a couple things, as the IMDb puts it, I love its categorization into a genre. It's an action-adventure comedy crime drama mystery thriller. But it's got a great cast: Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Ben Kingsley, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, James Earl Jones, and on and on. It's exciting and fun, and I think this is what the Mission Impossible movie should have been.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't have minded that. Though I know we've discussed before, I like Mission Impossible 3 quite a bit more than you like it, but I like it a lot more.
I also like it.
But yeah, that would be interesting. It would be cool to have seen maybe more Sneakers movies or more movies in this vein that sort of approach it intelligently without lots of machine gun fire. I'm going to pick another easy one for my number two pick, and that's 2001 A Space Odyssey by Stanley Kubrick from 1968. I've talked about it before, and it's such a strange movie for, I think, both of us, because I absolutely love parts of it and absolutely hate other parts of it, and if I could just take the good parts out of it, which specifically are the computer parts, it would be hands down my favorite science fiction film ever. But so let's go ahead and talk about those computer parts. HAL 9000, the computer, one of the most interesting characters in all of film history. He's a villain who has gone insane because he was programmed to do something that was against his programming. And I shouldn't even call him a him. I should be calling it an it. But there you see how easily it is to identify with the character and to make it almost into a person. I think it's fascinating the way the movie deals with this dilemma. What do you do with a machine like this? And again, the way it creates sympathy for Hal. I mentioned it way back in an early episode where we talked about sympathetic villains, but the ending sequence where Dave dismantles Hal and Hal pleads for its life just chills me every time I see it or think about it. It's a wonderful example of how you can make a computer seem human, and indeed how we make computers seem human.
Once again, I'm glad you picked this because I felt bad leaving it off my list, especially when I put Colossus, the Forbin Project there, which has the same sort of appeal. I agree with you, there's some parts that I just do not like at all, and others that I think are just brilliant. Well, my number one movie is a bit of a surprise to me. I wasn't expecting it to rank so high, but hey, this is a really fun movie with a lot of nice touches in it, and you probably haven't heard of it. It's called Hot Millions, and it was made in 1968. It's about an embezzler who gets out of prison and discovers that while he was locked up, the world has become computerized, making it that much more difficult to extort money out of insurance companies. But he gets a lead by hooking up with this computer programmer who's installed this system at a company. Meanwhile, the owner of this company is getting suspicious. Now, this sounds like the setup for a great crime caper, but this is a comedy. Roger Ebert wrote in his review that Stanley Kaufman wrote in his review that it didn't really make him laugh out loud, but at the end he realized he had been smiling for a full 2 hours. This is a quiet humor. It doesn't make you slap your knee and guffaw. I found myself chuckling a lot at all the clever little touches in here. There's this great scene where Bob Newhart, of all people, a brilliant comic actor who doesn't appear in movies much, but he's having lunch with someone and things are going his way. He has this agenda. And there's this great little gesture. He reaches up and straightens his tie and has this self-satisfied smirk on his face. I don't know if I'm making it sound like it looks, but it's just this really great finishing touch to a scene that already works on its own, and the movie is just full of them. I mean, wall to wall, these little touches and details that you just realize, wow, this is really well thought out. These glances and gestures and vocal inflections really put the polish on this movie and add a lot of fun. The cast is fantastic, a real special mix of comic talents that you don't tend to see. Peter Ustinov plays the embezzler, Robert Morley, Maggie Smith, Carl Malden, Cesar Romero, and of course I already mentioned Bob Newhart. Definitely worth checking out if you can find it.
Interesting. My number one pick is also a comedy, and it's not so much about computers, but about the people who work with them. And it's the 1999 cult classic Office Space by director and writer Mike Judge, and it's become a real cult classic. It kind of flopped in the movie theaters when it was released. Anyone who's ever worked in the computer industry, this movie absolutely perfectly captures what it's like to work for a large information technology company or division where everyone's working with computers, but a lot of people don't really seem to like them that much, and they're a source of frustration as much as they are anything else for people who maybe went into computers because they were actually interested in them. There's lots of nice little touches. I like the way that none of the Americans can pronounce the names of the foreign workers who so many information technology workers are contracted from overseas, and again, no one can ever pronounce their names either in the movies or in real life, and it's a funny source of amusement. And there's lots of other great moments that aren't necessarily related to computers, and also, though, a subplot in which the characters try and rip off a bunch of money from their company by writing a computer program that's going to steal a little bit of money over a long period of time from bank accounts, and thanks to some sloppy programming and a bug in the software, they end up taking a ton of money at once, which is sure to get them caught, and the way it all resolves is very clever and funny, and tells a lot about sort of the modern bureaucracy of working in this industry.
You know what, when people talk about this movie a lot with me, just joking back and forth and quoting all the memorable lines, and I'm right along with them in enjoying all these memorable lines and the jokes that have become sort of part of the culture in these technological environments, and yet, I actually really did not like this movie at all. I think of the only people, especially in technological fields, that just almost hated this movie.
Huh.
And yet, kind of like 2001, there are these scenes that are just so great in it, so I wish I could get rid of the things I don't like and just keep what I did like. I don't know. Well, anyway, to recap, my number six, embarrassingly enough, is The Net from 1995. My number five is Colossus, the Forbin Project from 1970. Number four, Tron from 1982. Number three, Desk Set from 1957. Number two, Sneakers from 1992. And number one, Hot Millions, 1968.
And my top six list, which actually features movies you've probably heard of. Number six, Sneakers from 1992. War Games by John Badham from 1983. Ridley Scott's 1982 sci-fi classic Blade Runner. The Matrix from 1999, directed by the Wachowski brothers. 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed in 1968 by Stanley Kubrick. And my top computer movie is Mike Judge's cult comedy classic Office Space from 1999. When you think of movie franchises, normally you think of sequels that were thrown together in a hurry so that the studios could sell more toys. But in the late 1950s, 60s, and 70s in France, a movie franchise was developed that doesn't at all conform to what we usually think of when we think of movie franchises. It's called, well, it doesn't really have a very formal title. It's usually sort of referred to these days, the box DVD set calls it The Adventures of Antoine Doinel, which is a weird title for a movie series that doesn't really have a whole lot of adventures in them, but in a sense it kind of works. The movies consist of five films made between 1959 and 1979, so that's a 20-year period, and they were directed by director François Truffaut, who was one of the most famous of the French directors and one of the most important directors in cinema history, because he helped really sort of change the way we think about movies. But it's important to note that these aren't stuffy French artsy films where people sit around pondering philosophy. These are the stories of Truffaut's life, and his first feature-length film was The 400 Blows in 1959, and it's the first movie in this series. The 400 Blows is the story of a kid named Antoine Doinel, who was loosely based around Truffaut, and he's played here by an actor named Jean-Pierre Léaud. Léaud was born in 1944, so during the filming of The 400 Blows, he's only 14, and so he's the actual age of the character, of course, and this is Léaud's first real role. And The 400 Blows follows this character of Doinel, who is, again, based on Truffaut, and it's about this kid who is smart and intellectual. He likes to read, but he's not fitting in well. He doesn't have a good home life. He's not doing well at all in school. It's sort of that kind of recurring theme you see in a lot of different things about smart kids who just don't do well for whatever reason in school. He's not an academic, even though he's something of an intellectual. And he gets into trouble, and the movie kind of ends ambiguously. We're not sure what's going to happen to him. We get the sense that he could go either way. If he continues down this path of not really fitting in anywhere, he might be in real trouble, but if he can get his act together, he might be better off. Well, in fact, you would think that there's the end of it. It's this wonderful, ambiguous ending. But Truffaut did something interesting. Just 3 years later, in 1962, he made a short film called Antoine and Colette. And it's a 20-minute movie that was made for what they call an omnibus. It was like an anthology, a couple different movies, a couple different shorts put together by different directors. And that omnibus was called Love at 20. It's about young love. And so this is a story about Antoine Doinel, who is now 17, and once again played by Jean-Pierre Léaud. And it's going to be interesting because Léaud is the only actor who's going to fill the Doinel role, and they all seem to take place roughly in real time. The series takes place over 20 years, and they were made over 20 years. So the actor and the director age along with the character. So the actor is always the same age as the character. And so we see both the actor grow up at the same time we see the character grow up. And in 1962, in Antoine and Colette, Antoine Doinel is 17. And he's independent now, he's working in a music shop, but he hasn't really matured very much. And it's about his first love. It's a good, tender little film about a young man's first real love affair with a woman who doesn't really reciprocate his love. In fact, it's kind of interesting. Her parents seem to like Antoine a lot more than she does, and this is sort of a recurring theme throughout the series, that Antoine gets along better with his love interest's parents than he gets along with his love interests. And so, you know, it's a short movie, not a ton to say about it, but it's interesting. And again, you think, well, this would be more or less the end of it. We've had a feature, we've had a short, but no. In 1968, it's been 6 years since the short, and almost 10 years since the original feature, Truffaut makes Stolen Kisses. And this is the story of now Antoine is in his mid-20s, and he's just gotten out of the military. The idea is that, you know, he's gone through some bad experiences, and he's basically being kicked out of the military. He's not being discharged under the best circumstances, because, of course, the recurring theme is Antoine does not do well in these sort of structures. And this really sort of mirrors Truffaut's life. He had sort of a troubled upbringing. He couldn't fit in well anywhere, and it wasn't until he began originally writing about movies and later making movies that he was able to find something that he could excel at. And so, again, we're going to see this with Antoine throughout the film series, that it's art. And Antoine, rather than being a movie director, Antoine becomes a writer, works in the literary field. But again, he finds solace through his art. But Stolen Kisses, I think both Sam and I would agree, it's the second peak of the series. The 400 Blows is the best film by far. But Stolen Kisses is probably the second best, and it's completely different than 400 Blows. Well, the 400 Blows had a sort of realistic but poetic feel. It's often credited with starting the French New Wave. It's kind of, it's not really sad, but it is a little grittier. It feels a little more realistic. Stolen Kisses is a very light kind of movie. It's very episodic. There's this recurring thing where Antoine has all these different jobs, and he's pursuing this woman he's in love with, but, you know, he has trouble committing to any one person or any one thing. He doesn't know what he wants to do, and he just kind of floats around. So there's all these little side stories about him failing at his latest job, and there's some interesting surprises that get resolved in unexpected ways. But the movie is this charming little romantic comedy. It's whimsical and funny, and it's about a guy who's now trying to move from being in love with a bunch of different people to being in love with one person.
Very definitely a tonal change there. Antoine and Colette, that follows more in the spirit of the 400 Blows, I think, in terms of the way it's made and the tone it sets. I mean, it's a little different,
right,
but it's very similar. And then, yeah, Stolen Kisses is like a bucket of cold water, and suddenly, well, it's not that unpleasant, but it's quite of a shocking change. And I think the change to color is at least part of it, because we have black and white in the earlier two films. Now we're using color here, and that sort of, I don't know that it creates the lighter mood, but definitely enhances it, and we come away from it remembering images that evoke very different feeling than they would be if this was also black and white.
Definitely. I think it also somewhat talks about the change in Truffaut's style to making films. His earliest movies are very much in the spirit of the New Wave and very much about sort of realistic things, but as he continues, he moves into color. From his earliest films were black and white, his later films are color, and he starts making more movies about art and less about realistic things, and he becomes, in a way, there are a lot of people who don't like Truffaut's later movies who are fans of his early ones, but yeah, I think it definitely represents a shift in Truffaut's approach to making film as well.
Interestingly, though, I think this is more watchable in terms of just entertainment than the earlier ones, I think.
But I think that's the criticism, as a lot of people are upset. They feel that in his early movies,
They had too much of a good time, huh?
Well, the idea is that in his early movies, Truffaut is tackling real issues, and in his later movies, they're a little fluffier.
Yeah, I see.
And I mean, if you compare it to someone like Godard, who's working at the same time, another French director, you know, Godard is consistently going to be political and attacking serious things, whereas Truffaut really gets away from most of that. Anyway, in 1970, we get Bed and Board, and this was originally intended to be the last film in the series to wrap it up, and it definitely feels, at the end of it, like it's a real conclusion. Antoine is married in this film to the woman he was pursuing in Stolen Kisses, and they're happily married, but also sort of not. Once again, Antoine has trouble committing to a single person. He's kind of got the domestic life that he always wanted. He didn't have it growing up as a kid, but he just finds he's not quite happy. So it's about people just trying to cope with a marriage and how to get along in it. And the ending seems to indicate Antoine has resolved it. He's happy. He's found a way to live in this situation, and he's found a way to resolve all these difficulties. And the series really feels like it's over. Well, it wasn't. In 1979, we're going to get Love on the Run. And it's not that it's a bad movie, necessarily. It's okay. It's that, unfortunately, it feels significantly weaker than the rest of them. I don't really think we needed it anymore. But it is interesting because this is going to be a full 20 years after 400 Blows. So now we find Antoine, who is divorced. And he meets up with Colette, his first love from the second film. And there's a lot of flashbacks. And we get to see that how Antoine has had some limited success as an author. And it's sort of about the way that our life takes unexpected turns, how we don't know in advance where we're going, and, you know, Antoine has ended up in a place that he never thought he would have when he was 17, so it's interesting from that perspective, but, you know, there's heavy use of flashbacks. A lot of the material in this movie is flashback to the earlier films, and, I mean, these were popular French movies at the time, so, you know, when this came out originally, it had been 9 years since the last Antoine Doinel film, but if you watch them all on DVD, you know, I watched them all, you know, within a couple of weeks of each other, it's like, well, we don't really need a flashback. I just saw all this.
It's like a greatest hits episode.
Right, and it doesn't quite work. But it's still interesting within the context of the series, because it is kind of neat to see how Antoine's doing and what's happened. And I think that the general overall theme about your life going in unexpected ways and how you know, the relationships that you think are really important at 17 may not be, and then who you are at 17 isn't who you're going to be at, you know, 37 necessarily.
Yeah, I share your opinion about Love on the Run. I think it's nice to have and it's worth watching, but for me, I like to end it at Bed and Board. In my head, that's where That's where the end of the series is.
Right.
And what Bed and Board implies with its ending about how he's going in his life is the way it really is. And Love on the Run is this fan fiction. Stolen Kisses and Bed and Board work really well together. Even if you've not seen the earlier ones, I think you can jump right in. Well, you can pretty much jump in at any of them. But for some reason, I think Stolen Kisses and Bed and Board work really well as a duology apart from the larger scope of the five.
Well, and especially because those two are made so close together. I mean, those were...
Yeah.
And the thing is, the way Bed and Board ends, like, the final scene seems to be a closing...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, but it's closure. You know, the other ones have ended sort of ambiguously, and this is the one that ends in a specific way, and then to go back and undo it...
I don't know. And moreover, Love on the Run's conclusion is not very convincing either.
No. But of course, Truffaut would pass away not too long after that, so we never, unfortunately... It would have been great to go back and see, like, you know, today... You know, another Dwanell movie with Dwanell as an older man. But, yeah, unfortunately, it's not the world's greatest ending to the series. But, you know, why should we care about this series? I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, of course, that Truffaut was one of the great directors, and we should probably care about most of his movies. But it's also just this unprecedented collaboration between an actor and a director. You never really see it. You see a lot of actors who work with directors a lot, but there's no one else who started working with a director when he was a teenager and continues to work with him up into his adulthood and who plays the same character. It feels like you're watching a real person grow up, because in a sense, you are. Truffaut and Leo had made other films together as well. These aren't their only collaborations, but these movies are interesting because they're about both of them. The character is based on Truffaut, but definitely Leo brings personality to it. And some of the DVD extras, Truffaut talks a lot about how Leo's performance inspires the writing and how they think of the character. It's not just Truffaut. It's sort of an interesting combination of the both of them, because these films are both of them. And that's an interesting and satisfying thing to see. And really, you know, the films are also quite good on their own, even without their important contact within film history. They're romantic without being overly sappy, which, if you're a loyal listener, you know is important to me, at least. Even the weaker one, Love on the Run, is still good. The rest are all excellent. And it's also interesting because it's reflective of the New Wave. If you're interested in film history or the French New Wave, these are probably a pretty good place to jump into it, because, like we mentioned before, you know, some of the New Wave films can get really really heavy and arty and weighty, and these are not that way at all, so they're probably a pretty good place to jump in. 400 Blows is really easy to watch, and then you have these other movies that are increasingly entertainment.
And they work very well as comedies as well. You mentioned the romantic angles, but these are pretty funny.
Absolutely.
Especially Stolen Kisses and Bed and Board.
Yeah, there's a lot of really memorable, funny scenes. Sam and I talk about a couple of them. We often actually forget which film these scenes are in. I have to argue over it, but there's a great scene in Stolen Kisses where I'm pretty sure Stolen Kisses. Dwanell is trying to learn English because this is a joke. François Truffaut constantly tried to learn English his entire life and couldn't, so of course Dwanell is doing the same thing, and he's sitting there listening to English records as they, you know, the record says the word and you have to repeat it, and he's doing that, and then he's trying to pronounce his own name with an American accent, and he's just sits there repeating Antoine Dwanell. Antoine Dwanell into a mirror. And I can't explain why. Probably all you listening are going to think we're crazy. It is absolutely hilarious to see it. It's funny and strange, and there's just something about Leo's performance and the tone of the scene that makes it really stick out in your mind. It's just a great moment of true-to-life humor, the funniness and weirdness of trying to learn a foreign language.
Yeah. Well, it's more than that, because he loses track of the language part and just starts repeating his name again and again and again. It's like a train. It's rhythmic. And when I was watching this, my wife was in the room but not really watching, and this sound caught her attention. She looked over and kind of cocked one eyebrow and said, "What are you watching, Sam?" And I couldn't tell her. I didn't know, really, what I was watching or what that scene was about at the time. But yeah, it's about learning the language. But then it becomes to be one of those really neat personal moments where, and we all do something like this, when nobody's watching, we'll do something just totally strange that defies explanation. This was one of these moments with him. And just because there's no logical explanation for why he's repeating his name again and again in the mirror doesn't mean it's not true to life. And I thought that was a really neat touch. But the other thing is, it turns into sort of a plot-related point, because he starts repeating the name of the woman that he has this crush on. And then I think he even appends his own last name to her first name. And so, you know, what if we were married kind of thing. And he's trying to get the feel for that sound. And so he repeats that over and over again as well. And so, you know, besides being this really neat true-to-life moment that defies explanation, it also tells us a little bit about where his state of mind is within the context of the story.
Right. And the great thing about these movies is they're all available on DVD. There's a really nice box set from the Criterion Collection, and they do pretty much the best DVDs in the world with lots of information. And one of my favorite extras on the DVDs are there's some early screen tests with Laode that they did before the 400 Below, so you can really see him and Truffaut kind of meeting for the first time, which is just after you've watched the entire series. It's kind of a special, neat thing that they still have that footage. So, yeah, if you're interested in checking it out, they are available. You can order on Amazon. Netflix has them. So, yeah, strongly recommend that you give them a look through.
That's it for this week, except the answer to our trivia question. Did I scare you for a moment there? Thought we were going to leave you without telling you the answer? Well, the questions were to name the first feature films to employ 2D and 3D computer-generated imagery. Steven, you didn't sound so sure you had the answer right. What do you think about when these movies might have been made?
Oh, this sounds like something that I've heard before, but I can't remember. I don't know. Let's see. I'm going to guess the 1960s.
Ooh, you're so close. You're so close. It is a little bit later than that, but it is the early 70s.
Oh, okay.
And it turns out that the answers to these questions are both parts of a two-film science fiction series. Very progressive for the day, but strangely unknown today. I think people have largely forgotten them. But the first was called Westworld, made in 1973 and starring Yul Brynner as a malfunctioning android in a theme park where the Old West and ancient Rome and medieval Europe are recreated for high-paying guests. Brynner is programmed to be one of those gunslingers in the Westworld. In fact, he's known only as the Gunslinger. And actually, it's kind of funny. He's wearing the same costume as he wore in the movie The Magnificent Seven, so he's almost parodying himself. But the 2D computer-generated imagery comes into play when we see shots from his point of view. The display he perceives looks all computery and pixelated. That's a real word, by the way, computery. Anyway, it took about 8 hours to render 10 seconds of footage of his view. Today, what they were doing would be practically instantaneous, though. It could be rendered real time, I'm sure, but, you know, this is the early 70s. Computers were far more primitive and bulky and definitely not the province of the average company, even. The first use of 3D computer-generated imagery was in its sequel, Future World, where the company opens a futuristic theme park in the same spirit as Westworld and all those, and Brynner reprises his role. The 3D animation comes into play when a human head and hand are rendered. The hand, interestingly, was modeled after the hand of Edwin Catmull, a pioneer in the art of computer graphics, basically inventing the practices of z-buffering and texture mapping and algorithms for anti-aliasing and rendering subdivision surfaces and all these other kinds of things. But he would later co-found Pixar and become a key developer on the software they use to render their animated features. So you can get started and make it big in the movies if you start out just by modeling hands for animation in feature films.
Good to know, Sam. I'm going to get started on learning how to model right now so I can bust into Hollywood.
That's it for our computer episode. But go on the internet using a computer and visit our website, allmovietalk.com, and also rinkworks.com. Check that out as well.
And next week, we're going to have, of course, as I'm fond of saying, a great show for you. I don't think we ever do anything less than great. Sometimes we do better than great, but anyway. And it's going to be a break from our normal format. We're going to do a recap of 2006, and also sort of a look ahead at 2007. So we're not going to have most of our usual segments. Instead, it's going to be an hour or so of Sam and I sort of chatting about what we liked about 2006, what we didn't like, and what we expect the future to look like.
Cut. Ugh. Oh, that was bad. Where's my coffee at?